there was a number of suicides in this building. The first room I lived in this house, I stayed there for 2 or 3 weeks over a winter break by myself. And I saw things that were incredible. I saw a doorknob turn on its own.
Oh my gosh.
The door opened. I saw, I would hear music that was ethereal. I saw flashes of light in the hallway that were like sort of like quite strange. And I grew up in a place that was notoriously haunted. Pennsylvania is like one of the most haunted places in America for whatever reason.
Okay.
So that's, you know, that's sort of my background on this stuff. But it's exciting to talk to you about some horror.
All right, welcome to a very spooky and very frightening Halloween special of The Popular Show. With me, James A. Smith.
And David Slavik, coming from a very haunted Newfoundland fishing village.
You might hear the ghostly voices of children on the tape in the background, as you often do on these shows. We're joined by Mary Wilde. She works for the National Film Archive here in the UK. She lectures at the Freud Museum in North London. And you can hear her on the Projections Film podcast and her own Patreon channel, which is one of the best kept secrets on Patreon, a wonderful combination of theory, film reviews, memoir, discussion of music. If you only subscribe to one channel on Patreon, then make it The Popular Show. If you subscribe to two, then throw Mary Wilde into the mix as well. Hi, Mary, how are you doing?
Hi, James. Thank you so much for the lovely introduction and for having me here on your show. I'm a big fan.
Hey, you're just starting up with the Freud Museum again this weekend. Yeah. Want to tell people about that because it's actually online at the moment.
Yeah, it is. So it is my annual course on women in horror films, which is taking place this weekend, the 30th and 31st of October for Halloween. And yeah, you can find details of that on the Freud Museum website, and you can easily sign on to attend online. It's open internationally.
So you two both grew up in North America, and Halloween is kind of growing in Britain, but it's always been a huge kind of holiday and a huge industry in the States and in Canada, I assume. What were your sort of memories or experiences of Halloween growing up?
Well, because I grew up in Montreal, oftentimes it would be snowing at Halloween. Mm. So we'd have to basically wear winter coats and be very, yeah, just be kept very warm with many layers of clothing on top of our actual costumes. So it was actually very weird to go trick-or-treating as kids with a lot of snowfall. And we knew we had a costume on, but nobody could see it.
David, what's your deal with Halloween?
Halloween was very special to us. We always had what we called Devil's Night the night before.
Devil's Night?
Devil's Night was a sort of prankster night that you would have with your friends, and you would go out and do mischief, and it was kind of approved. It was like state sanctioned. It was like the purge, but for children. And we lived very close to a lot of cornfields in Pennsylvania, and we used to do something called corning, which is self-explanatory, but we would, you'd steal the corn from, feed corn is very hard, you know, which is very different than the corn you eat. And we would shuck the feed corn, we'd put it into bags, and then we would throw it at people's houses, which doesn't actually damage the house typically, but it could.
It seems politer than toilet rolling.
Or eggs, or, you know, yeah. Eggs are like, you know, essential, you know.
Just a sort of uncanny rat-a-tat-tat of the corn.
So it
the
would
window.
Sound like a machine gun hitting your house.
Well, we've got together to talk about some horror movies. What do you guys get out of scary movies?
I don't know. It's like, it makes you feel alive. I think maybe I'm also a little bit into sometimes bringing along a friend to see a movie that I think will scare them seems a bit sadistic, maybe. But I do get a kick out of watching people squirm.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. That a bit like watching comedies, actually, these are sociable forms where you can only there's no such thing as watching a horror film on your own any more than there's such a thing as watching a gross out comedy or a kind of bro comedy or something on your own. It's the interaction between the friends watching it.
Yeah,
I mean that's interesting because of the move towards online.
Yeah.
And you have to think about this, you know, in that format. When I watched Scream, I watched it in person and it was a big deal. You know, it was like 97.
I mean, I'm really a cinema purist. I will sometimes watch things on DVD.
Yeah.
And if I have to, I'll watch it on a computer screen, but I don't consider that cinema. It has to be in a movie theater.
So I want to get to the way horror has changed over time. When Paranormal Activity came out, the use of like infrasound changed everything, you know, like these like subaltern sort of sounds that changed sort of how people are. If you watch it outside the movie theater, it's not as scary. I wonder if the pandemic has robbed us of the terror that we need to deal with this terror that we live.
That's a good question.
Much of the world is about dealing with uncomfortable situations.
Yeah.
And not being able to deal directly with horror is actually robbing us of the ability to deal with the horror of our lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, among the many tragedies, big and small, of COVID has been the unique situation where there's been an enormous shared trauma and a deprivation of the ability to share experiences with other people. So there has not been that kind of public mourning, but there's also not been that kind of public reckoning with extreme feeling, which can only happen with other, which I insist can only happen with other people. And that's been true since, you know, Aristotle was talking about tragedy as a form of shared kind of expulsion of awful feelings that people weren't able to remove in any other way.
Yeah, like achieving that collective catharsis.
And it allows us to acknowledge that we have the devil in us and that we need to push it out.
Yeah.
Or make friends with it. Or capture and rehabilitate it. Should we talk about these movies? We kind of collectively chose a couple of the big horror films of the summer or of the season, and we settled on the sequel / remake of Candyman, one of those films that I was terrified of long before I ever saw, terrified of like summaries of the plots told to me in the playground. So there's Candyman, the 2021 edition, directed by Nia DaCosta and written by Jordan Peele, the guy who established his reputation with one of the really great horror films of recent times, Get Out. And the other film we got here is Malignant, directed by James Wan.
I noticed that there was a lot of chatter about the Candyman film prior to its release. There are a lot of critics and like film influencers who were like counting down the days. They'd watched the trailer. They were very much anticipating this film. And so there was a lot of hype around it for sure. Whereas with Malignant, it sort of came out of nowhere. It wasn't on anyone's radar. When Malignant also was about to be released, typically a couple of weeks before a film's release in the industry, it's very common for the director to prearrange press screenings and, you know, give an opportunity to critics to kind of like engage with the film and then write their reviews in time with the release. But with Malignant, the director didn't arrange any press screenings because of the, I think because of the plot, you know, like the big reveal in the film, and he wanted to make it very secret. So what ended up happening is that it sort of just came in out of nowhere, and it blindsided a lot of critics who would have wanted to have a press screening. And it just got picked up as a kind of cultural item by audiences who were already going to the movies and seeing it. And there was just this big hype that was very organic, led by audiences and spectators. Yeah. And it is very divisive. People either love this movie or they hate it with a passion. I'm firmly in the camp. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, I would hear your opinion first.
Well, no, I was just going to say that I love Malignant. I think that Malignant is for sure the best film I've seen so far this year.
Yeah.
The most fun I've had at the cinema. We know James Wan from, you know, The Conjuring, Insidious, Saw, Aquaman, you know, I could go on, but he makes very commercial films. But here I feel like this film is very subversive compared to the stuff he's made before. And it's like a real commitment to unhinged camp. And it's very fun. It's harking back to the 80s and 90s horror films that set out to entertain audiences as much as, you know, scare them. And the film's most essential quality is very much its willingness to steadily and purposefully descend to the lowest levels of delirious lunacy and then just keep going further still. So for me, I thought it was brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed my time at the cinema watching this. I want to go and see it again. What did you guys think of it?
Okay, so this goes back to like the kind of the great age of the kind of whoa fucking hell kind of twist. This took me back to the kind of turn of the 2000s, where you had movies like Sixth Sense and Fight Club, kind of like whatever supernatural kind of movie. Sixth Sense is a good example.
Yeah.
So in this movie, we see this pregnant woman being beaten up by her abusive husband, and she starts seeing visions of murders that are taking place in real time. And bizarrely, the murderer appears to have the same name as an imaginary friend that she'd created as a child. And the twist here is that the murderer that the woman is having visions of is actually the like half-formed, I'm explaining it really badly. Someone else over and explain the science of the twist is.
No, I'll tell you, the funny thing is, and this is going to sound not like it was obvious. It wasn't obvious at all.
No.
I have twin children, and because I have twin children, I've
got a connection with this phone.
I've done more research on twin stuff than I should have, and
so this
we had the kids. I thought, what if we had conjoined twins? We do a bunch of research. I'm a horror fan, and I just like went down some internet
You know, we're very supportive of our conjoined brothers and sisters. And, like the murders happen and the fingerprints are upside down, and we see this freaky like guy running backwards. And okay, it turns out that the murderer is the conjoined, the wizened conjoined twin on the back of the woman's head under her hair, taking revenge on the world, committing these murders. I thought that was a pretty,
I know
great,
that sounds
great,
very
insane
strange,
twist.
But I had.
You're telling us it can happen.
Is that what you joined twin who told me? I don't know.
Mary, you didn't guess the twist. What did you feel was like particularly interesting about this?
Well, I mean, I thought it was very psychoanalytic because it's all, you know, sort of pointing to the fact that this is all really just a metaphor for her kind of unconscious desire that's kind of coming out, this repressed thing, this trauma, and the revenge fantasy belongs to her. She's just externalized it in the form of Gabriel. And to be honest with you, I have a lot of sympathy for Gabriel. I was rooting for him.
I knew you'd say that because he's a variation on the Joaquin Phoenix Joker.
Yeah,
you've got a great episode on your channel. I think you're quite right that the significance of it is that all of us would quite like to offshore all of our resentments and kind of hatred and unacceptable desire, and to have this twin who would go around kind of carrying out those actions on our behalf.
Yeah, exactly. It's very convenient as a fantasy of just externalizing all that pain and frustration and violent impulses. And then you're just left kind of, I suppose, like an innocent party. But I thought that the scene where we see her transform into effectively Gabriel in the holding cell, I thought that was masterful. Mm-hmm. When I saw that at the cinema, it moved me so much that I was actually tearful. seriously, that's like great. I felt so much I just felt so invigorated watching that transformation and just the extremely violent kills. I thought was just such a fun ride.
We've got to communicate something of the aesthetic of this film, because you were sort of saying it's got this kind of exaggeration aesthetic of the early 90s.
Oh yeah, like it's impossible not to admire the extravagant bad taste behind its go for broke energy, you know?
Yeah.
but what I thought was very good about the movie was that it was self-aware, but it moved on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it didn't take itself at all seriously, but yeah, that's part of its charm.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually think that it's because it doesn't take itself seriously that it works, whereas this Candyman film takes itself way too seriously, and that's why it doesn't work.
Boy, do I have some criticisms of Candyman, but...
Psychoanalysis gives a kind of vocabulary for thinking about the ways in which our weird thoughts and repressions and desires can kind of come to life. And as far as we're concerned, they are real objects that are out there in the world having an effect on things. And that's so often the logic of horror films. Like, and this one's a great example, that your fucked up repressions are literally there as a face on the back of your head. And when you drop your guard, your body starts running around, enacting these things, and you have to deal with the fallout. I found it interesting that maybe not so much the remake of Candyman, but the going back to the original, Malignant and the original Candyman are both in the genre of the wrong man, which we take from Hitchcock's film of that name. And there are a bunch of Hitchcock films about, you know, the idea that you've been framed for certain crimes that have been done by someone else, but you kind of wanted to do those crimes. And that's one of the kind of real connections between Hitchcock and Freud, that this idea that you can feel guilty for things happening that you wanted to happen, even if you weren't actually the agent in them. And this film seems like a great kind of performance of that, or enactment of that, that here is this kind of inverted you, quite literally running backwards with you know, all the joints kind of pointed in the wrong direction, doing its thing, but doing my thing behind my back.
Yeah, well said. And it's been you all along.
Waiting on the word come out the gospel singer's mouth.
So you want to do tarot cards?
I'm really excited about this. Mary's getting the cards out.
Yeah, I've got my cards right here. And they're from a deck called the Cosmic Tarot. Yeah. And who wants to go first?
I'm going to let James go first. That sounds great.
Okay.
All right. I'll go first.
Okay, James. I'm going to ask you to think about something that you want the cards to guide you on. Something specific. You can just think it privately.
Okay. I'm doing it.
I'm going to ask you to, I'm going to hover my hand over the the cards, and I'm going to ask you to tell me to stop when you want me to pick a card. Oh my gosh, interesting. Okay. You've got a very interesting reading here.
All right, what we got?
Okay, so
interesting is such a loaded word.
It's such a loaded word, isn't it?
Okay, so your first card, I don't know if you can see that, is the star. Okay, so this is only
a 3 month.
This is a 3 month reading.
Okay.
So your present situation is you've got the star.
I got the star, which is like a blue guy and a flamingo.
It's a young woman, actually. Okay, so this is actually a really nice card. On the surface of it, it signifies inspiration. You're inspired. So it's like, it's kind of it's a very whimsical card. So now your action card.
Okay.
So take a look.
It's what I got to do. This is some people emerging from the ground.
Yes.
The trumpets. Oh, it's Judgment Day, of course.
Yeah, this is the Judgment card.
So I need to start being more judgmental.
Definitely don't do that.
Just really letting people know what I think.
So this one is, this signifies transformation. Okay, so it's telling you that you're on you're on this path. You're kind of evolving from the star, and it's telling you to take action according to the Judgment card. And your future position is the Tower. The Tower, by the way, is known to deeply perturb people of your star sign.
The Capricorns do not like the Tower.
No.
We don't want to be in there. Welcome. We don't want to go up the stairs. We don't want to look at it. We don't want it on the skyline.
No, because...
I mean, actually, the 9/11, hijackers were Capricorns. This is an underknown aspect of the whole thing, is that all of those guys were Capricorns. That's a coincidence? You're telling me that's a coincidence?
I don't think so.
Come on.
The stars are determining.
We don't like the Towers.
Yeah. I mean, we've never heard the occultist official, story of 9/11.
Yeah, there's a reason for that.
There's a lot.
There's a reason.
There's a lot out there.
That's a rabbit hole I want to go down.
Gary Webb, a Toronto broadcaster, if you want to see, he's retired now. He's dead. But he had the best stuff on. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You're going to need to move the glass around on the board to get the real fucking takes from him.
Oh, my God. David, I'm just going to shuffle your cards for you.
All right, that's great.
Okay. So I'm going to lay them out, and I'm going to hover my hands over the cards, and you can tell me when you want me to pick a card, and I'm going to pick three cards for you. Okay, so it's a woman pouring water from two cups into a fresh stream bordered by irises. And there we can see also the sun peeking through, like half hidden by clouds. You've found some moderation in what you're doing. You're seeing some improvement in the work that you're doing. You're bringing people together.
And it's downhill from here. I would just keep the first card. Is that an option? I'll stick.
Very accurate.
Is it accurate for you?
It's absolutely accurate.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
It also says that you've been a matchmaker.
That's also true. Yeah.
Really?
So, yeah, I used to be a lobbyist. So that's okay. I used to actually bring people together. That was like what I did.
I should also tell you guys that every card in the tarot, or rather every star sign, like every zodiac sign.
Oh, you didn't ask me my sign.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't.
Yeah, no, you did ask me.
What is your Gemini?
I'm a Gemini. Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Forgive me, I didn't ask you your sign.
It's all right.
But I should say that every star sign is represented in the tarot. It has its own card. this one that you got, the Emperor, yeah, is actually James's star sign is Capricorn. Yeah. So that's interesting. That could mean your action
and
could,
part of the action.
David. You're part of the action.
Include me in the action. That's what that card means.
It's telling you that you need to be more mindful of shaping your material world. I can understand that because Geminis are very free-spirited people, yeah, and you might not naturally gravitate towards being like a disciplinarian.
Well, I'm married to a Gemini too, and my children are Geminis.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, so I have Gemini Whoa. Twins. I have Gemini twins, and my wife is a Gemini, and I'm a Gemini. Yeah.
Incredible. So and the Gemini is the sign of twins as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's amazing. Quite interesting.
Yeah,
people,
I mean,
people who are interested in astrology are very interested in our health. There was a night for the Sadie's jail. I remember that look in his eye. There was a night for the Sadie's
jail. Well, I remember the day I died. This new edition of Caddyman, Jordan Peele wrote it, and our friends over at Champagne Sharks, I think, said that Jordan Peele, he's proceeded to make movies for the white people from Get Out ever since. And I think that maybe sums up some of the reservations that people might have about Candyman. So, but the premise is that if you saw the first one, the baby saved from the fire at the end of the original Candyman has grown up to be a bourgeois visual artist. The projects, the estate that the original is so ominously set in, Cabrini Green, has been gentrified, and yeah, the adopted project's kid is now part of a fashionable black bourgeoisie.
Yeah, but I mean, it's funny because he's sort of a part of this middle class group, but at the same time I think he's really struggling because he's an artist, and he's trying to capture the magic of his previous show, but he's sort of in a artistic rut, and you can sense the pressure from his maybe girlfriend's brother or something. He's told a couple of times that he's not a breadwinner in that household, and that this is her apartment. And so I feel like he is actually quite out of place, and he feels those like neoliberal pressures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought it was very interesting because what was a little heavy handed when you go into there's a first scene. Well, it's not the first scene, but it's, you know, the first 20 minutes where he does a show at a friend's sort of gentrified art exhibit. And the person who's throwing the show actually gives him shit about his work, which I thought was funny because it was like in that position, he would have been held up. Mm. But I also had been to shows like that where there were sort of poor artists who got lifted up. I once went to a show where there was a artist that was in college where this guy had, he called himself Fire, which is, I thought, was pretty pretentious. This is in, you know, the 90s or early 2000s. And one of his paintings, which was quite good, had him nailed to a cross. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, I was like, come on, brother. And I saw that, but everyone pretended like it was normal. And I that's where I was like, it's not the ghost killing people that freaked me out or took me out of it. It was the fact that they didn't understand in 2020 that you're supposed to pretend that this guy's good.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, like, this is a post-George Floyd world that they're living in.
Yeah, and I mean, I think actually this movie is, you know, I actually think that if they had just stuck to the plot line of an artistic process,
yeah,
it could have actually been interesting. But I don't know. It ended up being very very confused about what it wanted to say. It seemed to have the intention to express like social justice issues, but yeah, this actually just ended up snapping me out of my suspension of disbelief, and it completely undermined the horror effect of the film for me.
Yes.
This was not a horror film.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that actually one of the things I value about horror movies is that they very often actually articulate the most powerful like conflicts about contemporary politics. And it's often in their incoherence that you feel a political moment registered. I mean, you go back to the Napoleonic Wars. What expressed the kind of chaos and anxiety of that time better? Jane Austen, a truly great artist, or the trashy gothic horrors of you know, bodies being dismantled and so on in the gothic literature of the time? Surely the second one, you know, it's often the kind of trashy horror that taps into that. But it can't do it when it's doing it deliberately. And yeah. In a film that sort of takes a very incoherent source material, as the original Candyman is ultimately, and tries to kind of force it into a kind of social justice frame. So the famous thing of, you know, saying the name of Candyman in the mirror becomes say his name, the conventional social justice kind of thing. So there was that, there was the... you know, the line Candyman is how we deal with the fact that these things happened and that they're still happening. All these kinds of woke lines which show that it isn't black people speaking to black people. A black person doesn't say to another black person they love what we make, but not us. There's a black person talking to a white person. Yeah. Even the kind of what could have been a really good scene where the sister has been wrongly arrested and is sat in the back of the police car, and she realizes the only way to escape is to summon Candyman, and she says the Candyman, you know, incantation, and Candyman turns up and kills all the cops. That's a really interesting repetition of the scene from the end of Get Out, where Jordan Peele does a very I don't think I'm naive in saying I think this is a great scene where you know, the conclusion of the horror movie does have the black protagonist lent over the flaccid body of the white woman, and suddenly the cops pull up, and this should be the moment where you're saved. Ah, the cops have arrived, I'm saved from the horror situation. But there's this awful moment where you think they're going to shoot him because, you know, it's a black guy crouched over a white woman. That is done, I think, quite artfully in Get Out, but the repetition of it here in a film that has kind of strong-armed or forced this quite uncanny source material into essentially, you know, feel-good woke TV, you know, the kind of, a film that feels like activism. It's amazing to see it kind of drop off the cliff, really.
Yeah, I think this movie would not have just voted for Obama for the third time. It would have worked for his foundation. It would be telling people right now, like, change happens too quickly. That was it felt like the sort of end stage of like this sort of discussion, you know. I like Jordan Peele. I liked his second movie. I liked, what was it, Us. I thought Us was brilliant.
It's good.
I thought this was like sort of it was almost a parody on sort of the idea that it was discussing. But I'm glad they made it. I thought it was actually like
you mentioned Scream before, and Scream is a horror movie where horror movies exist, and everyone knows what happens in them.
Yeah,
I mean, and actually the original Candyman kind of is that. It's a horror film where people have
terrifying
urban legends, and they kind of know horror tropes. Mm-hmm. So already that was kind of like Scream before Scream, but this is even more so.
It's like a little bit like post fear, an atheist horror movie in a way. Like there was all these people who didn't believe in anything, like even the artists.
Mary, did you have a sense of the kind of comparison between the old one and the new one?
Yeah, I mean, I thought the original Candyman was very scary.
Intensely scary.
Yeah, like truly effective horror film. Mm-hmm. Whereas I found this one, I genuinely was confused. Like even just in this one with like the retelling of the legend, using like the visual style of the like the silhouette images made.
It was like a Basquiat.
Do you remember the bit I'm talking about, like the miniature black cutouts?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I just found that it was so patronizing. It felt like it was, you know, this is like film 101. You don't you show, you don't tell. You don't need to like.
It was bad Babadook. That's what it was. Because like if people had said Babadook, which is actually a very similar movie in that you have to say it a certain amount of times.
Yeah.
There's an incantation. And it was about, but it was Australian. I think Australia is scary in general. Just by.
Very good film.
It's a brilliant film. The tension was there. The anxiety of sort of the characters were there. And I think that this was building upon that sort of trope where like, you're like, I have people in a sort of anxious situation, but I think it maybe it did this well is it acknowledged that the anxieties of sort of the upper middle class black person who is doing well don't actually reflect one, the history of who they are in their own heritage or who their contemporaries are outside their class structure.
And yeah.
I actually think that they may have been doing something very interesting there that I didn't necessarily pick up on because I'm not in the milieu.
For me, that I had an instinct of that kind as well. And I felt like it was actually picking up on something that's very interesting in the original, that Candy, the origin story of Candyman, of this freed slave who has become an artist and therefore paints portraits of well-to-do white folk and then sleeps with a white woman and is killed by a mob. Even that in the original to me is very interesting and sort of anticipates some of what the new one tried to do. Because in a sense, the original was the tragedy of the upwardly mobile already. Even though the film is about, you know, the white expert and her black fellow PhD student going into the projects and the uncanniness and the fear is a combination of the truly uncanny and supernatural, but also the fear that these well-to-do folk feel when they go into poverty. That class tension that was so important to the uncanniness of the original was already there in the origin story of Candyman, because it wasn't simply a slave has looked at a white woman, a poor black guy, the Emmett Till story has flirted with a white woman and been killed. It was already the tension of the black guy who's kind of moved into the white world in some way, and it's failed. And that, for me, kind of goes like a sort of red thread all the way through the movie, because Candyman in the original is not like Michael Myers, and he's not like the alien in Alien, and he's not like Jaws the shark, and he's not like Jaws in the James Bond movies. All of those objects of horror are the kind of relentless force of the id with no complications of ego. There's no neurosis in those figures. They just keep coming, and it doesn't matter what it is. They're going to swipe it and kill it and destroy it. Whereas Candyman is a ghost with psychology and complication and a certain amount of like complicated feelings about his own like racial status as well. He feels humiliated in the eyes of the humans who follow him, and that's why he needs to kind of commit this kind of great act. He's still attracted to white women specifically. My desire to you, as he says to the Hitchcock blonde protagonist. And there's also an interesting kind of reference that isn't in the new one, where the little boy describes one of his first killing as castrating this like mentally disabled black kid. And the little boy says, you're better off dead if you've been castrated. So there's also this kind of male sexual anxiety in him as well. He's very different to your standard kind of horror ghost, who's just this kind of awful force of destruction.
Yeah, absolutely. Fully agree with that. And I think that that's exactly why it would have been more interesting if they would have just gone down the path in this film of purely the artistic experience, like the artistic relevance of this guy who's trying to like reattain his previous, it's not even so much, maybe he's not even that motivated to have like the status of this kind of black excellence, you know, in the art world. Maybe he's genuinely just trying to achieve something powerful in his work, but I feel like there's too many things distracting from that. There could be really, there are some fantastic horror movies that are exclusively devoted to representing the artistic experience and how harrowing that is, how genuinely.
Suspiria.
Yeah, Suspiria, absolutely.
Both of them are great, yeah.
Yeah, Black Swan.
Yeah, Black Swan, yeah.
You know, there's so many great films that exclusively deal with that and how it demands a great sacrifice from the creator. I mean, actually, Darren Aronofsky's film Mother, you could say.
Mother is one of my favorite films.
Really?
Absolutely. And this is like what was also what was missing from this, I think, is that the divine feminine that you see in a lot of horror movies was not recognized here. Mm-hmm. Women were just like, and in horror movies, traditionally, women can just be props about culture, like, you know, sexual liberation. Women are like the slutty girl gets killed first, right? Or whatever, you know, the girl who puts herself out there when she shouldn't gets killed.
And actually, even the main female role, the sister, actually is reduced to being, you know, the sensible, you know, matriarch black woman, which is just a trope. Contrast that with the very complex, as I said before, Hitchcock blonde that Virginia Madsen is in the original, where, her desire is at stake. That's always the test. Never mind the Bechdel test. The test is your desire at stake.
I mean, even
then, that's when you're a character.
To get out, right? You know, the Allison Williams character is, her desires are really subsumed to the patriarchy and sort of white patriarchy and white supremacy. She is like, her desire is actually really just a vehicle for extending the white patriarchy. And I didn't see female desire as part of this, other than there's a woman who is saying, hey, you need to do better. And you know what, anybody who's married knows that you hear that every day. That's not a horror trope, you know.
Are you sure about that?
I mean, I told my address, I could feel the blade of his knife. I screamed and screamed, cause I knew he would take my life.
So Mary, this contrast between these two movies, which superficially are actually kind of similar, what can we take away from this about like what horror movies can do and what they should be doing?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about the same thing, and I believe that pitting these two against each other is a valuable lesson for filmmakers about what to do and what not to do. Just because I feel like with Malignant, it is very much embracing the absurdism of actually what it is to feel scared and what trauma really does to a person, and kind of just go with the kind of outlandish nature of that experiential reality of being caught up in a trauma and see where that takes you. Whereas in Candyman, yes, it's also dealing with trauma, and it's a very serious subject, but the filmmaker's intent, I think, was wrong-minded in being so earnest and so serious and trying to give out this like moralistic message in the film. I think as soon as you start doing that, you're actually acting against the mechanism of the experiential reality of horror, because horror doesn't deal in logic and social justice. You know, horror deals in something actually that you can't predict.
It's unjust.
Yeah, it's unjust. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just about how like viscerally uncertain the world is.
Yeah.
The conversation about the relationship between psychoanalysis and horror movies, about tarot cards and about much else. It continues on patreon.com/thepopularpod, where you've got a whole other episode with Mary Wild. Mary, we can't thank you enough for coming on The Popular Show to discuss these movies. This has been really, really cool. And the tarot reading was really eye-opening for both of us, I think, David.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure, and we hope to have you on again.
So people have got to, we're getting this episode out in time for people to jump onto your Freud Museum lectures over Halloween weekend. Check out that archive of great podcasts on the Projections feed and get on Mary Wild on patreon.com.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me as a guest and for being so welcoming. I've really liked talking to you both. It's been so pleasurable.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. It was not.